Been to the doctor recently? Been given the bum's rush? Been put off by the appointments procedure, as I have? Missed going as a result? Well, there's hope. Here's Dr. Gary Egger from the Southern Cross University in Lismore.
It's perhaps ironic that while health services have changed dramatically over the years, the delivery of these services has remained largely the same. If you've got a health problem, or even if you just need a checkup, you visit your doctor. You're usually in a closed room with just him or her for a hurried discussion about your problem. By necessity of demand, this is designed to get you in and out as quickly and efficiently as possible, so everyone else can get their equal share of care. You'll probably leave thinking, I forgot to ask about such and such, or I really didn't get a chance to talk because she was so busy typing my notes into the computer, or I didn't really understand what was said, it was so quick. Still, that's the system that's been with us for centuries. One expert advising you on what to do to improve your health, and little old you sitting back and lapping it up as the passive recipient. But is there any evidence that this is the best way to conduct healthcare? And could there be a better way, without too much change in the structure of the health system as a whole, to get a better outcome and greater satisfaction for both doctor and patient? I'm going to suggest here the time has come to reevaluate the approach, to maybe visit the doctor in a different way, where things are more laid back and more of your questions get answered. And even the doctor feels more relaxed and confident that what she prescribes is more likely to be acted on by you. But before we get there, we need to look at why all this may be necessary by examining the changing nature of health. For millennia, human health has been a struggle against two things: microbial organisms, many of which cause diseases that can be passed on from person to person, and the wounds inflicted on us by nature or our fellow human beings. Both of these problems have haunted humanity since we climbed out of the primordial swamp. And because they struck potently and often, they severely limited longevity. By the end of the 18th century, the average human could expect just 3 to 4 decades on the planet, and that's if you were lucky enough to survive childbirth. All that changed, of course, with the Industrial Revolution, which brought not only machines and new sources of power, but improved standards of living. This led to improvements in public health, the introduction of improved food and water standards, and most importantly, a new way of thinking about those unseen microbes that doggedly kept turning up in the presence of disease. Such a change in thinking had its origins in early philosophy, but only really took root with the Dutch inventor Van Leeuwenhoek's development of the microscope in the 17th century, down the barrel of which small wiggly things like bacteria and protozoa came to life. Although it took a further 200 years, Robert Koch's development in the 1880s of what came to be known as Koch's postulates, proving the disease consequences of microorganisms, led on to the immensely important germ theory of disease, in which such organisms were bundled together as germs. This enabled health scientists to launch a more concentrated attack on these through immunisation, even better public health, and ultimately the development of the sulfonamides, the antibiotics, and other medical and surgical innovations. By the 1970s, when I started in health, the infectious diseases were all but defeated. It was confidently predicted that man's battle against disease had all but been won. But of course, we'd neglected the advice of the great epidemiologists of the day that changes in social conditions invariably lead to changes in disease. The Industrial Revolution and economic development spurred by this had indeed brought the infectious microorganisms responsible for acute health problems to their little knees. But in their stead, a new range of diseases arose, the chronic diseases, that are largely induced by the way we live rather than by any microbial being. And while it's true that the infectious diseases are attempting a comeback through new incarnations, SARS, MERS, bird flu, and now Ebola are cases in point, the biggest afflictions are the chronic diseases like heart disease, type 2 diabetes, respiratory problems, cancers, and musculoskeletal problems, to name just a few. But paradoxically, what led to our at least seeming defeat of the infectious diseases, economic growth, has been behind the rise in chronic diseases, having been responsible for what I've called anthropogens, or man-made environments, their byproducts, and the lifestyles encouraged by these, many of which may cause disease. These include overly processed and nutrient-deficient foods, effort-saving technologies like motor vehicles, which have reduced our levels of physical activity, a different form of stress to that suffered just trying to survive, and now even endocrine disrupting chemicals in the air, water and soil that can influence natural physiological reactions. The diminishing rates of return from economic growth hit a crossroads in Western countries around 1980, when an epidemiological transition occurred and chronic diseases took over from the infectious form as the major cause of ill health and disability. Now, I know this is a long way around talking about health services delivery, but bear with me, dear listener, as we are getting close. Chronic diseases like type 2 diabetes, chronic obstructive pulmonary disorders, cancers and musculoskeletal problems are, as defined, chronic or long-term. They're also complex and are brought on by lifestyle and environmental factors that are extremely difficult to change. Lifestyle, because of the complexity of changing the driving factors, like a diet that's most enjoyable but quite toxic, to one which may seem austere and restrictive but healthy. And environments, like chemicals in the atmosphere, which require a worldwide political will to change. Unlike infections, which can quite often be dealt with at the primary care level with a medical prescription, chronic diseases need more time and attention than can be given in a 6 to 10 minute consultation. Health authorities tried to deal with this in 1999 by tacking on payment to the existing Medicare benefits. They developed special item numbers for group sessions with a health expert, such as a diabetes educator for diabetes or a cardiac rehab specialist for heart disease. But just as the 6 minute one-on-one medical consultation lacks educational input, the educational group lacks medical input. What's needed is a middle road. The Americans, with all the deficiencies of their healthcare system, came up with a strategy in the 1990s called group visits or shared medical appointments. This was developed by an American clinician, Dr. Ed Noffsinger, who, when very sick himself in the 1980s, decided that what he would like more from his healthcare system was three things. One, immediate accessibility to the doctor of his choice. Two, having more time to discuss his problem with that doctor. And three, getting support and information from others with similar health problems. Noffsinger trialled sequential consultations with up to 15 people at a time seeing the doctor over the course of an hour, and with 2 to 3 other health professionals in the room doing their thing for up to 20 minutes before and after the doctor entered the room. This then became an individual consultation, but with others listening, observing, and where appropriate, participating in the consultation. Both patients and doctors seemed to benefit. So in the following years, he tested it with the most extreme groups, homeless native Indians in British Columbia, mental health cases in San Francisco, cancer survivors in Ohio. It worked well and was extremely popular under all conditions, and hence expanded to Canada and other parts of Europe. The idea was never seriously considered in Australia, however, because of the belief that Medicare compensation items drawn up in the infectious disease era of the 1970s only allowed, in quotes, a single consultation with a single patient on a single occasion. Health workers seem to overlook the fact that it is a single consultation with a single patient on a single occasion. It's just that several others may be watching and chipping into the conversation based on their own experiences. After discussions with Medicare and an application for a new Medicare item number, it was decided to test the idea of shared medical appointments in Australia. With a grant from the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners, the Australian Lifestyle Medicine Association in Sydney and the Baker International Diabetes Institute in Melbourne trialled a number of shared medical appointments over 6 months in different parts of the country. And while the trial didn't run long enough to measure the health outcomes from this, which incidentally have been shown to be as good, if not better than, from a single one-on-one consultation in overseas studies, patient and provider satisfaction with the process was found to be overwhelming. Over 90% of patients from around 220 shared visits claimed they would probably or definitely continue to use shared medical appointments if they were available at their medical centre. 95% rated them as a good or great form of medical care, and most thought they would be good for anyone. Of particular interest was the popularity amongst one group of Indigenous men with whom the process was tested 3 times. all found it much more valuable and less threatening than the often scary experience for them of seeing a doctor alone in a closed office. The main attraction for all patients is peer support and getting information from others about their similar problems and how they manage these. But they also like the more relaxed time with the doctor, not having the doctor looking at the computer instead of them to type in medical records, having more time for asking questions, and having questions asked and answered that you might not otherwise think of. Importantly, over 60% claimed one shared medical appointment would reduce the number of other one-to-one visits they would need with their doctor. The mean number of other visits they thought one SMA would reduce over a year was 2.5. Now, just with diabetes, if every type 2 diabetic patient in Australia went to the doctor one less time in a year, this would save the health system over $100 million. Factor in heart disease, respiratory problems, and all the other chronic disease ailments, and you've got huge potential cost savings through such a simple change in process. On the provider side, all of the doctors involved enjoyed the group visits approach and wanted to continue being involved in these. They benefited mostly from not having to repeat the same advice over and over to patients, not having to type in medical records, these are inputted by a facilitator, being able to relax and hear patients share experiences more, and getting other patients to contribute practical advice. The key to a good shared medical appointment is the facilitator, who runs the show for the doctor, keeps him or her on time, and can also contribute to the consultation in some cases. Currently, there's no such creature in the Australian healthcare system, but practice nurses, who make up one of the fastest growing professions in the country, are ideally suited to take on the role with minimal extra training. Naturally, the first obstacle that crops up when shared medical appointments are mentioned is confidentiality. How can I talk to my doctor about personal matters without somebody else in the group going off and telling the rest of the world about this? Well, participants do sign a confidentiality agreement to protect against this. But we were shocked at the level of intimacy patients shared with each other in a group situation once they got started, from sexual function and erectile dysfunction to bowel habits. Perhaps this shouldn't come as a surprise, says Ed Nofsinger, who claims never to have had a confidentiality problem in over 100,000 patient visits. Just listen to patients in a waiting room and you know you don't have to worry about confidentiality. And while shared medical appointments are not for every patient, the only real restriction to their expansion into Australian medical centres, apart from Medicare compensation, which is currently being worked out, is the reluctance of doctors to change a system which they've never been taught to question. However, with chronic disease now making up around 70% of all presentations to primary care, with costs rising rapidly and with no apparent end to the chronic disease epidemic in sight, all options need to be put on the table. Of course, the idea of shared medical appointments is not to replace standard medical consultations, but to provide an adjunct to these in specific cases where they are likely to be most helpful. Improvements in the science of medicine mean we know so much about the content of diseases, what causes them, what prevents them, and the medical interventions that may help treat them, albeit at an increasing cost. What we need more of is a conscientious look at processes. How do we manage chronically ill patients and help them manage themselves in an era of chronic disease with drastically changed causality? So instead of the response that the doctor can see you one day next month when you ring up to book an appointment at your local medical centre, the answer might soon be, the doctor will see all of you now. It could just make healthcare delivery a little more fun for both clinicians and patients.
Well, I hope so. Dr. Gary Egger is from the Southern Cross University and the Australian Lifestyle Medicine Association. Next week's talk comes from Yeppoon in Queensland, Melvin Bolton on being the right size. I'm Robin Williams.